Jamie Oliver has been one of Britain's most famous chefs for over a decade. He's also known for his work with young people, both in providing a place to train them to work in the restaurant industry and in his efforts to get British schools to provide better food. Now he has a new cooking show on the Food Network called Jamie at Home and a book by the same name subtitled Cook Your Way to the Good Life. It's published by Hyperion. I'm very pleased that it brings Jamie Oliver to the show. Welcome back.
How are you doing? Lovely to be here.
Now, we are going to be talking about Thanksgiving later, but Thanksgiving is not a holiday that is celebrated in Britain. No. I'm not even sure that people eat much turkey in England, do they?
For the last 70 years, turkey's been the Christmas meat of choice.
Over ham.
Well, originally it was goose. The classic English Christmas dinner would have been goose sort of 100 years ago. But, of course, a wild goose or even a farm goose can't be packed into small areas and produced cheaply. So, and the turkey can, along with chicken. So the chicken is definitely the meat of choice at Christmas.
And both birds are roasted as they are for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, they can be rubbed, they can be roasted. I kind of like the Jewish-American style of salting it beforehand. I think that does some quite incredible things to the texture of the skin and the meat. I've done that personally for the last couple of years now. But, just beautiful roasting. All the trimmings, roast veggies, cranberry sauce. And
cranberries, too. Wow.
Yeah, well, it's funny, you know, we were looking at, we're doing a show at the moment around America, and we were sort of doing our research, and cranberries originate from the city near to where I come from in England, which is Cambridge, which I guess is like your equivalent of Harvard. Then they were brought from there to America, and then they made all the sort of floodplains back into sort of inland, and we lost all our cranberries. So really, you've got them all now, and we buy them off you.
Well, your book focuses on your home garden, which doesn't have cranberries. It even gives readers
not
tips.
Yet.
Well, it takes a lot of space, yeah. As you say. You got to have a lot of water.
Never say never.
You give tips on how to grow food.
Yeah.
When did you start keeping a garden of this sort?
Well, I mean, I grew up in the country, but I lived above a family business, which was a pub. And my dad was one of the early sort of gastronomes that brought good food into pubs, which I still think today is a beautiful mix, you know, sort of having low ceilings, lit fireplaces, you know, cask ales and really good homemade pastries and stews and, you know, and really good things like fish and chips and roasts and grilled meats and stuff like that. So he was doing that. He's still doing it now, 33 years ago. I grew above that. But we didn't have a garden, but I was surrounded by farmers. And then really, I mean, I've always worked very closely with producers in my restaurants. But about 3 years ago, I started growing. And I was a bit embarrassed about it because I thought it was for oldies and hippies.
And you say now it makes you look at food differently.
Yeah, totally.
Now, we used to do this during World War II. Victory Gardens were very popular.
Big for Victory, yeah. Did you have that in the States here as well?
We did.
Yeah.
At least people who could, who had the space. And this is a problem. Not everyone has a place to home garden. I assume you just suggest that those people try to buy as local as possible.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's an incredible increase of farmers markets now. I think relationships with butchers, fishmongers, people, you know, these people are sitting there doing their thing. They come up and sell once, twice a week. If you buy off them once, twice a week, they'll remember your face, don't you worry. And at the end of the day, when they need to get rid of stuff, they'll do you a little deal. They'll give you things to try. And I think, you know, those sort of relationships are pretty precious. But, you know, we had a lot of experiments with growing stuff this year. And, you know, I've got friends that live on the 37th floor of a block of flats, and he's growing courgettes from a bucket. And, like, the courgettes are going all over the place. You've got beans going up to next-door neighbours. And
well, do you grow things that you think you're going to be using in your recipes when you're when you're cooking at home or cooking in a restaurant, or is it the other way around?
I mix. There's obviously bog standard stuff that you love and need: potatoes, onions, leeks, herbs. There's stuff that will just sit there and live and pop back up every year, like rhubarb and asparagus and herbs. They'll just kind of work for you for many, many years. And then I just kind of flick through the seed books, and it's very cheap to buy seeds and see which catches my eye. And then I like to do some bonker stuff. You know, if it says it probably won't dry, grow in an English climate, I think, right, let's see if we can, you know. So do a bit of experimenting. But I think, you know, food is such a, you know, we kind of, as consumers in England and America, we get an edited choice. For instance, the carrot. Now, the carrot that we have is orange. And that was never the case. The original carrot was almost purple.
We're starting to see them at farmers markets in New York again.
And that was the original. And in the 16th century, the very famous Dutch growers, who were very responsible for a lot of seed production, celebrated their royal family, the House of Orange, and they grew only orange carrots, and that went around the world. So, you know, so little stories like that, and of course, you show a fussy kid yellow carrots, white carrots, black carrots, you know, they go crazy.
Does it affect the taste?
You get some variance on taste, but not that much.
So it's really just a carrot is a carrot, just the color on the outside is different.
Yeah,
the inside is orange anyway.
And not always. You get whites, yellows, pinks, and even beetroots. You get the Chioggia beetroot, which is like a candy-colored, like vivid purple and white. It's incredible.
Well, in this country, we're starting to see more and more heirloom vegetables, especially at the farmer's market. But home gardening is a good way to grow them, although aren't they a little more difficult to grow?
No, exactly. Same.
Because I would think that the tomatoes that we get, the ones that are packed in Florida, they must just grow like weeds.
Yeah, but you've got to remember, if it's in your back garden, it's not going to need to be packed or shipped or last for a month. I mean, I think that's the joy. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a tough guy or a rude boy or whatever you might be. Like, if you grow something, it's quite humbling and you can't rush it. And but also the other joy that you get is, you know, if you look at, say, like a pea, you know, as that pea's, you get pea shoots, which are incredible in salads or dropped into pastas at the last minute or put in broths. And then it goes to a sort of like a mange too, you know, it's a tiny little pea and you can eat the whole thing. And then the peas start to form and you eat that as a pea. But then if you let them get real big, then you can dry them and do funky stuff.
That's in Chinese cuisine, snow peas were a really important ingredient. And then they started growing them here and it was the leaves, the shoots that became the more expensive part. Now that's pretty much what dominates Chinese
that's
restaurant cooking.
That's called taking advantage and of a good byproduct.
Well, but some people like me just do not have green thumbs. So that can be a problem, can't it? And growing vegetables out of flower pots is not the same thing as having a backyard.
No, it's not. I mean, I think, but there are certain things that are easy in pots, chilies, tomatoes. I mean, I go to like the hardware store and buy one of those kind of double pillowcase bags of organic peat-free soil. You can grow loads of stuff in that. And I think more than anything, I don't believe that people like you can't do it. I think we all get into routines in life and hopefully every now and again there's a little opportunity to try something different. And I've never been an academic anything. And my first year of growing in my back garden 4 years ago was like anarchy. And I tell you why, because they're all Italian seeds. I speak a bit of Italian, but not enough to be that good. I couldn't understand what they were saying. So I just, you know what, I had some decent soil. There was a bit of sun coming and I chucked the seeds in. All wrong. I did it all wrong. And you know what? Yes, it was chaos. It was a bit of anarchy. And it wasn't like a British garden where it's all trained and stuff. But I reckon 70-80% of what I planted, like an idiot, grew. And I ate well from it. And there was 30% of stuff that went pear-shaped. But, you know, it's all getting it wrong is also about learning how to do it.
It's interesting that we're coming to this now. In France, many restaurants have gardens in the back where they just grow as many ingredients as they can.
Yeah, I mean,
chef goes out and pulls something out of the soil.
It's very hard to grow everything unless you're blessed with quite a large amount of land. And even then, you know, sort of successively sowing seeds to sort of, so you get a constant trail of something for 4 or 5 months, it's kind of requires a bit of organisation. But I think certainly there's a lot of things you can do. I mean, like, you know, a friend of mine went and bought a flat and he was concluding all his paperwork and he knew it was going to be a month before he moved in, and he very cheekily went out into the garden, kicked up the mud, distributed a load of salad seeds, and then when he moved and zucchini seeds, and then when he moved in 6 weeks later, guess what, he had a garden of salads.
My guest is Jamie Oliver, whose latest book is called Jamie at Home: Cook Your Way to the Good Life. It's published by Hyperion. And it's divided into four seasons, not surprisingly. This is something that we also have to keep in mind, that different things grow at different times of the year. In colder climates like this or in England, we have a lot of root vegetables in the wintertime. That's okay?
It's great. I mean, you know, the big man upstairs is a clever boy. You know, he's planned the tempo of the year to, you know, if you look at the veg that's growing now, it's lots of cabbages. You've got the frost coming. The frost breaks down the connective parts of the cabbages to make them tender and intensify flavour. We've got root veg. You know, you can still have things like carrots, turnips and stuff in the ground now. Salads are insanely good at this time of year. All the Asian stuff, all the mustard cresses and stuff like that. So you can have a reasonably large amount of stuff coming out of the garden even now.
We have posted some of the recipes from the book, Plum Tart, pork chops with carrots and beets,
yeah,
and some pickled vegetables as well. People can find that on our show page at WNYC.org. You include a number of recipes that use rhubarb. Did you find that that's a spring vegetable? And a lot of people are afraid of rhubarb, partly because it can be rather sour. They like sweeter things, and also because it has a reputation for being poisonous.
Yeah, well, all of those things you've said are correct. Rhubarb's kind of like an old trustworthy friend, you know. You plant that little baby in your garden, you find a corner for it, it will live for about 25 years. Its kind of body under the ground is like an octopus. And yes, it does come up in spring, and you can put a cloche over it and it will be delicate and pink and fine. But you know what? Take it off, you know, let the sun kiss the leaves and get the energy into the plant, and that will go on growing for 6, 7 months, 8 months of the year. The leaves are poisonous. You're not going to die from it, but it'll probably give you some serious stomach aches.
I've never seen anybody eat leaves from rhubarb anyway.
Well, the problem was, you see, when they came over, I'm referring to England, but when they came over to England in the 1700s, it looked very much like chard, Swiss chard or blet, as the French call it. Very similar leaves and vein structure. And the stupid English started eating the leaves and started getting ill. So they actually didn't eat it for another 90 years before they worked out it was the stalk that was golden. But of course, yeah, you counteract that sourness with sugar, and you make amazing compotes, pies, puddings, even using that sourness as a vehicle, like you'd use vinegar or apples with pork, you know, to contrast acidity with richness and fatness. You can make it work for you.
Another ingredient you focus on in the book is eggs. You don't keep chickens, do you?
I do, yeah.
You've devoted
I have 150 of the little
really?
Little blighters. Well, I did a documentary
you
at the start
have some
of the
space.
Year. I did a documentary at the start of the year, telling the story of the systems of producing eggs and chicken meat, and to work with our English body of the RSPCA, who are the kind of animal loving society, to get the tick from them to say I was a good person. I had to take all these chickens home.
You say you rescued some factory hens from a refuge.
Yeah, 300 of them. So I've been giving eggs away for the last year, but they're kind of a nice present.
Well, you devote a whole page to the various types of eggs available: conventional, factory raised eggs, free range, organic. Can you taste the difference, or is it really is it more a matter of health?
I think it's a bundle of things. We try to sort of prove that an animal that could display natural behaviour and peck around, we try to prove stuff. Undoubtedly, if an animal's fit and healthy, and if it's getting extra protein from grubs and bugs and stuff like that, as well as a controlled feed, you know, I think you can definitely taste it. For me, it's more of, I think you can taste it, you can see it in the pertness of the yolk. And I think, but more to the case, you know, I think it's like any human that ever saw a chicken in a battery cage would never, ever buy it. So there's a real lack of honesty in packaging in England and America, you know, where they'll sell you an egg that's never seen the light of day, but they'll have a little bit of blade of grass on the packaging, you know, it's a bit confusing.
There's a Proposition 2 just passed in California. It requires more humane confinement conditions for chickens, for pregnant sows and veal calves. Are there regulations like that in Britain?
I think we're probably leading the way, funnily enough.
Because we don't have them here in New York.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's good that your sort of devolved power down to sort of different states in America means that places like California can do quite radical stuff. And also, at the same time, they're capping the amount of junk food shops on high streets. And I think that's an absolutely responsible thing to do when you've got a hard-to-reach area of people that have health problems. But, you know, in Great Britain, we've banned the use of sow stalls, and we've banned the battery cage, and rest of Europe still can use it. But I think, you know, as a meat eater, I'm happy to eat meat, but I think you have to respect the life it has before it's killed, you know?
Yeah, in some ways, what you're doing in England is what Alice Waters is doing here. In fact, she has a program in the Berkeley schools. I don't know if your program in England is similar, but she wants, she feels that if kids learn what how food is grown, then they're going to be a lot more adventurous as eaters.
Yeah, the fact, definitely. You know, I've been following Alice for 20 years. She's been an inspiration, and she, you know, I think, you know, I think it's what she's tapping into is a very basic primal thing. If you show a kid how something grows, if you get them involved in growing it or making choices and picking it, they'll eat it. And that is a fact. And I've done a lot of stuff, you know, inspired in some ways by the stuff that she's done. And, you know, I really can't, everyone always thinks it's the problems with the kids. It's not the kids. It's like, you know, if you get them involved in food instead of it just coming out of a microwave, they get really engaged, really excited, and they will try stuff.
But you, but kids also have peer pressure to go to fast food places, and there's a McDonald's and Burger King in England too.
Yeah, but McDonald's in the UK is totally different to McDonald's here. McDonald's in the UK actually is, dare I say it, quite pioneering and incredible. I mean, they sell more organic milk than anyone else in the country. They sell more free-range eggs than anyone else in the country. Their meat is of a higher spec than anyone, you know, than most most other people in the high street. But the funny thing is that obviously American franchise hasn't got the same values. So it's quite amazing that two same companies can be so different.
What is the project you're working on now called the Ministry of Food? What's that about? The
Ministry of Food is an old department of the British government from the 1940s and the Second World War, where essentially England as an island was starving, or we had starved in the First World War, and we didn't want to have the same problems. So what was quite exciting about the Ministry of Food was, you know, in 2008 we're facing health crisis, in the sense of we are the third most obese country in the world, behind America and South America. Our kids that are born now are expected to live a shorter life than their parents. Type 2 diabetes, the National Health Service, which is the hospitals, is falling apart and crumbling because 68% of people in hospital are there because of a diet-related reason of one or the other, which I'm sure can only be worse in the States.
And this is after England has improved its food, because years ago it was breakfast could be toast and drippings.
Yeah, but you're really talking about restaurants and sort of and the frequency of good restaurants, which of course is, you know, like New York's got great restaurants, but we've still got health issues here as well. I think it's about the home. The Ministry of Food's about the home, and the reason I dedicated this show and the book that I did with it to the Ministry of Food in the 1940s was because that was the last time that the British government did something radical, and they mobilised 3,000 women to go to people all around the country, into factories, into the workplace, into the high street, into the supermarkets, to teach everyone how to use rations. And it's so relevant now, isn't it? Like New York, I mean, America and England are both in recession, money's tight, and these same values are the same now. So the Ministry of Food really is about teaching people how to cook basic food.
And if you have a little plot of land, you can also save money at the store by growing your own.
God, yeah.
Jamie Oliver will be talking and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at Union Square. The book, Jamie at Home, Cook Your Way to the Good Life. It is published by Hyperion, and it has been my great pleasure to have you
back
on the show.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, lovely to meet you again.